From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Bollywood. We talk with Shashi Tharoor about his new novel, set in the gaudy, escapist, enormous Indian film industry. Tharoor is from India, but now works at the UN with the Yugoslavia peacekeeping operation, which he'll also talk to us about. Also, gay pornography in the age of AIDS. We talk with essayist, activist, and pornographer John Preston. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Spike Lee's long-awaited new movie about Malcolm X. And world music commentator Milo Miles reviews the new album by Tanzania's political musician Remy Ongala. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The State Department's Inspector General said today that he found no evidence that the White House was involved in the speed-up of a search of Bill Clinton's passport files. Sherman Funk reported today on the results of his month-long investigation.
The basic conclusion of the report is that there was indeed an attempt to use the Department of State, the records and the people of the Department of State to influence the outcome of a presidential election. That is a very heinous activity, and shame on the Department of State that it happened.
Acting Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger took responsibility for the improper search and apologized for it, but he maintained that the White House had no involvement.
There is no credible evidence to support the allegation that anyone in the department was acting at the direction of someone outside the department. I would be naive if I did not expect that people will question these conclusions.
The Inspector General's report found that Elizabeth Tamposi and other officials speeded up the search in hopes of finding something that would discredit Bill Clinton. After she was fired last week, Tamposi reportedly said that she acted after she was told that the White House wanted the information. Negotiators for the United States and the European Community are meeting in Washington in an effort to avoid a trade war. The two sides are trying to resolve their dispute over subsidies to European farmers, an issue that's holding up the completion of a worldwide agreement to liberalize trade rules. Reports from Pakistan say that a number of opposition figures have been taken into custody as thousands of people attempted to take part in a protest march on the capital, Islamabad, to press for new elections. One report from the Reuters News Service says opposition leader Benazir Bhutto was deported to the southern city of Karachi and told that she may not return to the capital for 30 days. Lise Doucette has more from Islamabad.
The government says she's not under arrest, but there's no doubt Ms. Bhutto is being held against her will. She was taken away after an extraordinary day in the capital, struck by wooden batons and pelted with tear gas. She still declared victory. The Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, insisted he couldn't allow what he called an act of rebellion. Opposition leaders clearly want to build public pressure to bring down this government. But the government's overkill made clashes inevitable and caused the kind of unrestrained violence which is certain to haunt them.
Lise Doucette reporting for the BBC. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 14 points to close at 3,207. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading of 219 million shares. This is NPR. The Pentagon said today that it's considering buying military technology from Russia, including an advanced type of ejection seat for use in supersonic American military jets. The seat was among 13 pieces of foreign military equipment that the Pentagon said it will begin testing this fiscal year. The K-36 ejection seat was designed by the Soviets and inherited by the Russians. It's said to be able to safely eject a pilot from an aircraft flying at speeds of more than 2,000 miles an hour. A major hurdle has been cleared that could lead to the end of the six-month-old newspaper strike in Pittsburgh. Kevin Gavin of member station WDUQ reports.
The owners of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette have reached a tentative contract agreement with the Teamsters delivery drivers who walked off the job May 17th. William Block, chairman of the Post-Gazette, says this pact is the key to clearing the way for agreements with the other nine unions. The Post-Gazette is trying to buy the Pittsburgh Press Company from E.W. Scripps. Len Baselovic of the Save the Press campaign calls it a step in the right direction.
There's considerably more that has to be done. Agreements with the other unions, the approval of the Justice Department, the financing of the block deal.
The Post-Gazette must reach contract agreements with the other unions by November 30th, or the sale is off. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Gavin in Pittsburgh.
The gambling and resort company Caesars World said today that it's been chosen to build a $20 million casino in Palm Springs, California. Caesars was chosen by the Agua Caliente tribe, which has large land holdings in the Palm Springs area and which enjoys the right to operate games of chance on its territory. The casino could create competition for gambling operations in Las Vegas because it would be much closer to Los Angeles. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Shashi Tharoor, spends his days trying to keep peace in the world. In his spare time, he writes novels about India, where he grew up. He's the special assistant to the Undersecretary General of the UN, charged with peacekeeping operations. Tharoor is the team leader of the operation in the former Yugoslavia. We invited him to talk with us about his new novel and his work at the UN, although he cautioned us that the peacekeeping work is of such a sensitive nature that he can't say much about it publicly. Tharoor's new satirical novel, Show Business, is set in India's film industry, which cranks out a huge number of gaudy escapist movies. The main character is an actor who tries to bring 20th century Western classics to the Indian stage. But no one's interested, and he's broke. So he enters the movie industry and surprisingly becomes a big star. His popularity leads him into politics, which gives Tharoor the opportunity to make connections between the phoniness of politics and show business. Here's a reading from the opening of Show Business.
I can't believe I'm doing this. Me, Ashok Banjara, product of the finest public school in independent India, secretary of the Shakespeare Society at St. Francis's College, no less, not to mention son of the Minister of State for Minor Textiles, chasing an aging actress around a papier-mâché tree in an artificial drizzle, lip-syncing to the tinny inanities of an aspiring and highly aspirating playback singer. But it is me. It's my mouth that's moving in soundless ardour. It's my feet that are scudding treeward in faithful obeisance to the unlikely choreography of the dance director. Move, step, turn, as sari-clad Abha, yesterday's heartthrob, old enough to be my mother and just about beginning to show it, nimbly evades my practiced lunge and runs, famous bust out-thrust, to the temporary shelter of an improbably leafy branch. I follow, head tilted back, arms outstretched, pretending to sing. I shall always chase you to the ends of the earth. I want to embrace you from Pahalgam to Perth, my love. My arms encircle her, but as my fingertips meet, she ducks, dancing, and slips out of my clutches, pirouetting gaily away. Drenched chiffon clings to the pointed cones of her blouse, but she raises one end of the soaked sari pallav to half cover her face, holding the edge across the bridge of her perfect nose in practiced coyness. Her large eyes imprison me, then blink in release. Despite myself, I marvel. She has done this for 20 years. It is my first attempt. I shall always chase you from now till my rebirth, and it's only when I face you that I feel I know my worth, my love. I shall always chase you. I'll never feel the dearth of my desire to lace you around my... Cut! I'm caught in mid-gesture, mid-movement, mid-word. The playback track screeches to a stop. I freeze, feeling as foolish as I imagine I must look. Abha snaps her irritation, turns away.
And that's Shashi Tharoor reading from his new novel, Show Business. You know, I think it's amazing to most Americans that India has a larger film industry than America does. Tell me why you wanted to set your novel in the Indian film industry.
Well, I've been very concerned with the kinds of stories that a society tells about itself. That was the implicit theme of my first novel, The Great Indian Novel, in which I attempted something slightly more ambitious, perhaps, in retelling the political history of 20th century India through a reinterpretation of events and episodes and characters from our 2,000-year-old epic, the Mahabharata. Here, instead of taking the myths and legends of our ancient past. I've taken some of the modern myths, if you like, the escapist myths that are portrayed and churned out every day for the edification of India's masses. And let's not forget, India is a country where half the population is still illiterate and where cinema remains in many ways the principal source of entertainment for the vast majority of our people. So the stories, the ambience, the films themselves in every respect contribute to a great extent to people's perceptions, both of the world around them, of what might be, and of what they want to escape to when they turn away from the world immediately around them.
So what are some of the time-tested stories that the movies tell and retell and tell again?
Well, I should stress that in this novel I'm concerned primarily with the sort of formulaic B-movie type, a popular film made by Bombay, made by Bollywood, as it's irreverently called. These films are, as I say, stereotyped. They have the inevitable, you know, rich boy meets poor girl or poor boy meets rich girl formula. There's several stories featuring separated twins or separated siblings, one of whom, you know, grows up as a policeman, the other one as a cop, and I mean as a crook, and they meet at some climactic moment three-fourths of the way through the movie. There's fairly simple juxtapositions of good and evil, evil being personalized usually in the individual of played by the villain. And there are actors who made entire careers out of doing nothing but playing villains, just as there are others who made entire careers out of playing heroes. And it's very rarely that a hero can descend into villainy or a villain become a hero once he's been fixed in the public imagination as a villain. It's formulaic, but it's essentially fun, and often, in the old cliche, good clean fun, because a lot of the more explicit natures of human interaction are left out of Hindi films. I mean, kissing was only permitted very recently and doesn't happen too often yet. But there's a lot that's suggested, that there's a lot that sparks off the imagination. There's lots of songs and music and dance, by the way, the infusion of these traditional folk elements into this modern Western medium, the cinema. So all of this combined to create an artificial world, a world which really bears no relation to anything that anyone watching that movie is ever likely to encounter in real life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Shashi Tharoor, and his new novel, Show Business, is set in India, in the Indian film industry. You're involved both with literature and politics. You studied at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy in mm-hmm. the United States. You now work with the UN, mm-hmm. with the peacekeeping force in Yugoslavia. And you're a novelist. What has kept you with one foot in the world of the arts and the other foot in the world of politics?
A very uncomfortable posture, I can tell you. Well, the fact is that I see myself in many ways as a human being with a number of concerns about the world, some of which I express in my work, which was for refugees for 11 and a half years before I moved to peacekeeping, and some of which I express through my writing, both fiction in the novels and short stories I've written, and non-fiction in the shape of a scholarly book I've produced and articles occasionally in the mass media. So I try to, if you like, express my reactions to the world in both sets of ways. Increasingly, of course, it becomes difficult to juggle both identities. And indeed, as a person with a family, I have twin boys who are now 8 and demand more and more of what little leisure time I have. I'm discovering that it's not always easy to keep one foot on both stools. One starts slipping and you find the fall can be quite precipitous. But I do feel that as far as possible and to the extent I can, I would like to sustain both identities, both roles, both lives. I'm immensely challenged by what I'm doing. I work as Special Assistant to the Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, and though I'm supposed to have a finger in all the various peacekeeping pies around the world, the one which specifically is on my plate is the very difficult operation in Yugoslavia. And it's not one which has been replete with satisfactions for us. We've worked very long hours and many seven-day weeks on end without being able to feel that we have made the kind of difference that we would have liked to have been able to make. But we haven't given up by a long chalk, and though tragedies continue in many ways, we do have the sense that some of what our peacekeeping force in that area is doing has created a situation that's better than what might obtain if we weren't there. It's not saying a lot, but it's something.
I know that you wish not to talk about most of the work that you're doing with the peacekeeping force, but I wonder if you could tell us something about the nature of the process that you're working with.
Well, I went out to Yugoslavia during the conflict last year with the Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, and my boss, Under Secretary General Goulding, and on several other visits to help negotiate the plan that the United Nations has attempted to implement in Croatia. And I've been out there on subsequent trips, both to brief some of the soldiers we sent out to start implementing this work, and to see how things were getting along, and indeed then to watch, sadly, the descent into anarchy in Bosnia, which wasn't even an initial target of our plan. Here at headquarters, there's an awful lot to be done with the Security Council, with the representatives of the very many governments that have an intimate interest in what's going on out there, and indeed in dealing with the press and non-governmental organizations, various members of the public who are trying to pursue this matter. So while by being here, I no longer have the kind of hands-on role I had as we were beginning to set up this operation when I made 7 or 8 visits in the first 8 or 9 months of that operation, I am intimately involved with every aspect of what we are experiencing out there, and it's my responsibility to help manage that operation from headquarters.
What's it been like for you emotionally to be in a country, the United States, that's not at war, trying to come up with a plan for peace in a country that is at war?
It's been wrenching in many ways, Terry, and particularly so because there's so much in Yugoslavia that's unlike many of the other countries in which I have worked for both refugees and now in peacekeeping. It's a country which in several respects has all the attributes, all the appearances of a developed Western country, very much like the one in which I happen to be living now. And it's very strange when you see people in jeans and denim jackets and Reebok shoes running for cover from snipers. It's not quite the same thing as the images of horror and deprivation that we have all become used to seeing from less fortunate parts of the world. Here is a society which in so many respects would appear to have the trappings of what the world understands by modernity. And it's caught up in this grotesque, inhumane, savage conflict, which, for lack of a better word, is a tribal war. And that dissonance between the appearance of the societies, of the society itself, and the nature of what's going on in there, I think particularly drives home to you what is the tragedy you're witnessing.
The UN has peacekeeping operations in 13 countries. 47,000 troops are involved. How optimistic are you that UN peacekeeping can really be effective in keeping international peace?
Well, peacekeeping has worked remarkably well in a number of situations around the world over the years, but it has always required the existence of a peace to be kept. In other words, peacekeeping goes in when the parties to a conflict want the United Nations to come in and help them to uphold an agreement that they've reached. It requires the consent of the parties to the conflict and their active cooperation. The problem we're finding increasingly, though, is that UN peacekeeping operations are being thrust into situations where these basics don't always exist, and where very often when the clamour goes up for the UN to do something, what that something is not always carefully defined. So peacekeeping can only go in to do what the Security Council authorises and mandates it to do. It is not peace enforcement, as many editorial writers mistakenly seem to think. And so what it can do is really help parties to achieve something that they are willing to achieve. It's very difficult for a peacekeeping force to enforce a peace if the parties to a particular conflict do not want peace.
You've been living away from India for many years and working with the United Nations, but both of your novels are set in India. You were educated, you got your PhD at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy, mm-hmm. in Tufts University in the United States. Mm-hmm. Did you ever plan to return to India after you came to the States for your doctorate?
Very much so, and it's a plan I haven't entirely given up yet. But I found myself far too involved in the work I've been doing, which has kept me outside India, and that's made it difficult to go back. I do try and manage a visit every year, often for as long as a month or even slightly more if I can manage it every year. And my parents still live there, and I have a lot of friends whom I keep close touch with. I am very concerned about events in India. It's the defining experience of my life was growing up in India and confronting the various issues which the challenges that India face give rise to in any thinking person's mind. And therefore, India matters a great deal to me, and I'd like very much to matter to India.
You must have such a truly international scope on things. You're an Indian living in the United States, working at the United Nations, mm-hmm. and working now with the peacekeeping team for Yugoslavia. So, I mean, your eyes are on all different parts of the world at once.
That's true, and it's something which I think an Indian upbringing uniquely fits you for. You know, when you grew up in India, especially because 200 years of British rule left us with one good thing, their language, you do have access to a great deal of international information, consciousness of what's happening in the rest of the world, and an exposure to it without at the same time being separated from the Indian roots that give you a sense of your identity and of the nature of life that is very different from what you might acquire growing up in the developed English-speaking world. So coming from India, having lived in India, but at the same time having had one's mind shaped and quickened by the opportunities provided by information and knowledge from the rest of the world, you do find yourself able in the international arena to put your serve the interests of these different causes without seeing any inherent contradiction in them.
Shashi Tharoor is the author of the new novel Show Business. He's special assistant to the Under Secretary General of the UN, charged with peacekeeping operations. Milo Miles reviews new music from Tanzania after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Trying to interpret the politics of popular music from other countries isn't always easy, but world music critic Milo Miles says there's no problem understanding the activism and appreciating the humanism of Tanzania's Remy Angala.
No more embassies! No more passport! No more flags!
No more immigration!
No more boundaries!
No more border!
No more policemen!
No more prisoners!
No more refugees!
One man, different color,
from the same father.
One heart,
one choice, one blood, one love,
one voice, one world.
The universalist sentiment, one love, one world, took its current international shape when Bob Marley was preaching it more than 15 years ago. I can never decide if it's a beautiful idea or kind of creepy, but at any rate, it's simply not true. Not yet, anyway. You do not fully understand a culture by eating its food and appreciating its music, and no better proof exists than America's muddled perceptions of politics in African pop. By now, we're very used to thinking of the real blood-and-guts pop musician as a rebel, an opponent of the establishment. So African performers like Fela Kuti, Sonny Okosins, and Thomas Mapfumo make immediate sense to American fans. These performers are leftists and activists, or at least write protest songs. But some Afropop fans are uncomfortable with the fact that gorgeous juju music often serves as a soundtrack for Nigerian yuppies. Even more troubling are praise songs, sung in many African countries, which sometimes flatter the rich and powerful and expect favors in return. It's hard to remember that in impoverished nations, musicians are often considered beggars and must desperately seek patrons.
One reason that Remy Ongala is about the most appealing of Africa's political musicians is that he's both sensitive and down-to-earth enough to recognize going home as a profound political desire. His song, I Want to Go Home, tugs at refugees on street corners as well as those set adrift in their souls. It's from his new album, Mambo, which, by the way, means affairs or comments, and has nothing to do with those guys who play songs of love. About half the time on Mambo, Ongala sings in English. As is usually the case with such ventures, his first language fits more snugly into the arrangements. As is not usually the case, the English used is vivid and smart. Ongala was born in Zaire and plays a highly modified version of that country's most popular style, soukous. He also traveled around Central Africa picking up folk rhythms before he settled in Tanzania. But he never emigrated to Paris with other soukous musicians who picked up syndrums and synthesizers. As a result, Ongala and the Super Metamilla Band have an old-fashioned handmade warmth to their ensemble work. Even more important, they excel at polyrhythms that are a bit slower and much more elastic than is the soukous norm nowadays.
Wafanyaji magendo wala kuzi wasio wajibika na wale wanao hujumu uchumi wa taifa. Mrema huyo.
Ongala is very popular in Tanzania, and he's supposed to be fearlessly independent in his beliefs. Well, I hear far more songs praising his revolutionary government than ones criticizing its stagnant Marxist economy, but perhaps his laments for the poor complain indirectly. A standout track in his 1989 debut album, Songs for the Poor Man, was called The Voice of the Underdog. And though speaking in more general terms, Ongala triumphs singing about poverty on Mambo with No Money, No Life. In one particularly wrenching passage, he cries, "Life without money is like punishment. Life without money, no respect." Now there's a platform that gets my vote.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Remy Ongala's new album, Mambo, is on the Virgin Real World label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the safest sex, reading pornography. We talk with gay activist and editor John Preston about why he started writing pornography. One of his books is a cult classic. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Spike Lee's new movie about Malcolm X. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to the State Department's Inspector General, a search of Bill Clinton's passport files was an effort to use the records and employees of a government agency to influence the outcome of a presidential election. He based his findings on a probe of the controversy. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
While he called the search of Clinton's files heinous, Inspector General Sherman Funk concluded there was no evidence of criminal wrongdoing, and he concluded that the White House did not direct the search. Funk conceded that the White House was clearly interested in following up rumors that Clinton, as a student, explored the possibility of renouncing his citizenship to evade the draft. And he said White House interest in the matter was communicated to the State Department official who conducted the search, Assistant Secretary Elizabeth Tamposi, who has since been fired. But Funk said there was, quote, not a scintilla of evidence that the White House ordered her to conduct the search. Acting Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger.
This entire episode put the State Department front and center in the one place it should never be, the political arena.
Eagleburger said he offered to resign over the matter, but that the president had said no. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
President-elect Bill Clinton spent nearly 2 hours at the White House today before paying a visit to an ethnic business area of downtown Washington. It's the first visit by Clinton to the nation's capital since his election, and he called his meeting with President Bush in the Oval Office terrific. Clinton said that Mr. Bush was very candid and gave him the benefit of his thinking about a lot of things. More than 3,000 refugees from Somalia have left a ship at the port city of Aden in Yemen after an exhausting voyage to escape war and famine. Sophie Fisher reports for the BBC.
It took 4 hours to ferry all of the refugees from the Somal to their temporary homes in tents on a beach. Aid workers say 3,000 people were on board, packed together in appalling conditions. However, most were in good shape considering what they had been through. Only about 200 people needed immediate medical care, and there are no reports of any deaths, although the people still have to be fully interviewed and registered. However, it is now known that the refugees sailed from southern Somalia 12 days ago and spent 4 days on board before that waiting to sail. In that time, they had little food and drinking water. The refugees will now spend 2 or 3 days at a temporary beach site before being transferred to a more permanent camp, which already houses 10,000 other Somali refugees.
Sophie Fisher reporting for the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 14 points to close at 3,207.37 on volume of more than 219 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. In Paris, the French government has once again stated its opposition to a quick agreement between the European Community and the U.S. on farm subsidies. The statement came only hours before another effort to head off a trade war. France is opposed to any more cuts in EC farm subsidies, in addition to ones announced earlier this year. Washington has been demanding more cuts, charging subsidies give EC farmers an unfair advantage. An Illinois man is suing R.J. Reynolds, charging that the nation's second largest tobacco company conspired to hide the dangers of smoking. Analysts say this case could set a precedent for dozens of similar lawsuits pending against tobacco companies. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
In the opening statements of the trial today in St. Clair County Circuit Court, the attorney for Charles Cooper told the jury he would prove that the defendants, R.J. Reynolds, the Tobacco Institute, and the store where Cooper bought the cigarettes, were involved in a conspiracy to get people to smoke their products, knowing they caused disease. Cooper, who is 51 years old, has inoperable lung cancer. He claims the cancer was caused by smoking a pack and a half of Winston cigarettes a day. But lawyers defending R.J. Reynolds contend that smokers use the tobacco products voluntarily, accepting any risks associated with smoking cigarettes. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling earlier this year limited the grounds for these kinds of lawsuits, but established that warnings on cigarette packages do not shield manufacturers from all claims against them. I'm Kathy Lohr reporting.
A 24-hour strike by co-pilots and flight engineers of Japan Airlines has forced the airline to cancel three international flights. Most of the airline's domestic flights are said not to be affected by the job action over higher bonuses. Bonuses are paid twice a year and make up a major part of a Japanese worker's pay. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. How dare you even think that? That's what John Preston's grandmother said when she accidentally discovered a pornographic story he'd written. But that's part of what an artist does, express the thoughts that others may try to repress. Preston's pornographic novels have a big gay following. Pornography represents just one facet of his work. He's a gay activist, essayist, and editor who has recently compiled anthologies featuring gay men writing about their families and their hometowns. His recent book, Flesh and the Word, is an anthology of erotic writing. Preston's papers are being collected by Brown University's John Hay Library. In the opening essay to his anthology, A Member of the Family, Gay Men Write About Their Families, Preston writes this, "I had to leave my family to be gay."
I had to leave my family because I wasn't willing to subject my much younger brothers to the potential ridicule and damage they could do if I were to be the public person I wanted to be.
Your brothers were 15 and 17 years younger than you.
Yeah.
What were you afraid would happen to them if you were out in your hometown while they were growing up?
Oh, you really have to remember that we're talking about the early 60s when there was no context for a gay life and no context for gay activism. And the idea of being publicly identified as a homosexual at that point in time, and especially for them living in a small New England town, was impossible. It would have been quite devastating.
So you left to protect them, but you later found out that one of them thought that that wasn't, didn't really understand that that's why you left.
No, he didn't. And it was one of the great shocks in my life when he came to me when he was 18 years old and gave me his side of the story.
Which was what?
I had left a letter to my parents explaining that I needed to go, that I wasn't being able to do what I had to do with my life in our hometown, and accusing all of us of being quite crazy and incapable. What I didn't know was that my brother had found that letter and that he had felt that he was the one who was at fault, and that it was his fault that I had left home and abandoned him.
What couldn't you have done with living in the same town as your family?
Well, I guess the best way to answer that is to tell you what I did do. I moved to Minneapolis precisely because I knew no one. I had no history there. I was unfettered. And I went about recreating my own life. I became a very well-known activist in the Twin Cities. I established the first gay community center in the United States in Minneapolis. I started the first counseling center for lesbians and gay men that was federally funded, and became this part of the new people who were coming about right after the Stonewall Revolution about 25 years ago. But I also did it with a great deal of, I can't say flamboyance. That probably has too many other connotations, but I did it without restriction. I was on television. I was in the daily newspaper. I picketed. I did all those wonderful things that young activists do with their surge of self-righteousness.
Now, you've since moved back to New England, where you're from, and you've also recently edited an anthology about homecomings, about people who have returned back. What brought you back, not to your hometown, but back to New England?
Well, there are two primary motivations. One was that about 12 years ago, it became obvious that I might be able to make my life as a writer. and that is who I wanted to be. And I had lived in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, gone to college in Chicago. To be a writer, though, the cities had ceased to be any kind of stimulation, and they were an enormous distraction. I needed to calm life down. I chose Portland, Maine, which I felt, very correctly, it turns out, was the smallest city I could live in. But I also needed to go back to New England. And I wanted very much to go back to New England. As exciting as my life had been, when I lived in other places, I was never at home. I never felt quite comfortable. I had given up too much in my need to construct a gay life, it seems. And sometimes you just get to the place where a friend of mine finally said, you know, about living in California, the ocean's on the wrong side. And you can't really describe it much better than that. But the ocean's on the right side in Portland, Maine.
Now, you've written a lot of pornography, and to a lot of people, that's just the lowest form of literature that there is. You obviously don't agree with that. What do you think the importance of pornography is?
Well, I think, I think there are so many different ways in which it's important. You know, although I have to admit that I started writing pornography precisely because I didn't think it was important. I had to be taught by readers that it was. I decided, well, I'll write some pornography and no one will pay attention to it. And so I began, the first piece of fiction I ever wrote was became the first chapter in a novel called Mr. Benson. And I was convinced that, you know, this was like a free down in a game or something. No one would ever notice I had done it. But it immediately became this cult classic. And I was living in New York at the time, and I discovered going to work that people were wearing T-shirts looking for Mr. Benson. And so I thought, well, my God, I have to take this very seriously, don't I?
The pornography you write is filled with kind of S&M scenarios. Can you talk a little bit about why you gravitated to that kind of writing?
Well, mainly because that's where drama is. There's a great drama to workings of submission and domination, and I'm fascinated by them. I'm fascinated by how people do them, and I'm fascinated by what happens to them. Writing for me is an exploration as much as anything else. And it's an exploration of my own and other people's fantasies.
There's something, I think, very disturbing about a lot of sadomasochistic fantasies and sadomasochistic pornography. I mean, it has to do with degradation and with violence, even if it's only the image of violence. Have you ever been disturbed by your own fantasies?
I actually wouldn't... I wouldn't consider a novel successful if there weren't a scene that gave me a stomachache.
Why?
Well, because it means that I hadn't been pressing any boundaries and I wasn't really exploring anything. I probably write pornography the way other people consume it, read it. You know, it's there to excite me, and to help me define what the edges are and the places beyond which I wouldn't go.
So would you go places in your writing that you wouldn't go in real life?
Oh, sure. I absolutely. I mean, you know, my friend Anne Rice has written a lot of pornography as well, has a great statement about that. Pornography is a place you visit. It's not a place you live.
My guest is writer, editor, and activist John Preston. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer John Preston. You have a really interesting essay that was reprinted in an anthology called High Risk. Mm-hmm. And this was the beginning of the essay was about how you had written your first pornographic short story, and you'd foolishly left it on the kitchen table, where it was soon discovered by your grandmother, who read it. And after she read it, she said to you,
"How dare you think these things?"
Yeah. And what was your response to that? How dare you think these things?
I was horrified. I mean, I felt totally shamed. I felt I had done something just horrible in even thinking these things. She tore up that story, by the way, in front of me. And I didn't write fiction again until Mr. Benson.
How many years was that?
Oh, boy. 20.
And you think that has to do with the fact that your grandmother was so upset and had torn it up?
Oh, it certainly told me how dangerous it was going to be to have thoughts like that on paper.
How did the AIDS epidemic change your writing? How did you try to bring safe sex into the pornography you were writing?
Well, when all this happened, my immediate response was to do two books on safe sex, to eroticize safe sex, Hot Living and Safe Sex, The Ultimate Erotic Guide. An easy time with all of that. My hard time came about 5-6 years ago when I got my own AIDS diagnosis. And in my crisis, in response to that, it wasn't that erotica necessarily was something I stopped writing, but I stopped writing for 2 years. And I discovered that one of the things that I was being deprived of in my panic over my diagnosis and so forth was any form of erotic life and imagination. So actually I used erotica at that point as one of the ways in which I came back into living again and to not being not surrendering my life. I also did use that point to do a lot of my most serious writing and did an anthology called Personal Dispatches, Writers Confront AIDS. And that was important to me because that was a collection of those essays that I, as a person with AIDS, initially couldn't stand to read. They were too painful, and they made life much too bleak. But they were also too real.
You actually went back to find one of your forebears, I guess we could call him. And this is somebody who had written homosexual pornography under a pen name.
Right.
And he wrote under the name Phil Andros, and his real name was Samuel Stewart. How did you find him? And did he give you any advice? Or
he had been one of the great heroes of gay life for a long, long time, and his work has come in and out of print over the last 25 years. And I discovered that Phil Andros was this man named Samuel Stewart, who now lived and still does live in Berkeley, California. It was that information was some of the most exciting pieces of information I've ever gotten in my life, that this person actually existed and I could get a hold of him. It took a lot of work. I can't remember how I tracked him down. But I did, and we started to write each other, and I read some of his work that had been published under his own name, and he had been a protege of Gertrude Stein's. So, and quite a literary figure in his youth. And I eventually went to Sam to visit him. I spent a couple weeks doing an oral history of his life, and we quite fell in love with each other. And he had believed that his life was going to go totally unnoticed. And so he has all these wonderful things. He's always collected memorabilia. My favorite is he has a tuft of Rudolph Valentino's pubic hair. But anyhow, at the end of it, for him to have young men suddenly coming to visit him and to care about his life and to encourage him to write his autobiography, which I and some others did and which was eventually published, just astonished him. But he was also an enormous fan of my writing, and so we had a ritual where he tattooed me, and it was the passing of the torch from Phil Andros to Mr. Benson, and it's I have a quill dipping into a pink triangle on my chest.
That's an interesting symbol.
Yeah, he came up with it. He had been a tattoo artist for a significant part of his life.
That's really interesting. I think your work would be a lot more socially acceptable if you called it erotica and not pornography. What's the difference to you? Is there one?
The only difference is the packaging. I don't believe that I have never in my life, as much as I've read it, heard any distinction between erotica and pornography that has anything to do with anything but price. And I totally reject that there's any difference between them at all. I think that Flesh and the Word has been quite well received as a work of erotica, and to a certain extent that amuses me because it began, all the separate pieces were in, most of them were in magazines, which would be immediately labeled pornography. And there is nothing in that translation from pornography to erotica that has anything to do with anything but packaging.
Well, some people think that erotica is a more kind of loving and gentle thing, whereas pornography is more vulgar.
I don't buy any of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just don't. I mean, there can be a great deal of vulgarity in heterosexual marriage, and there can be a great deal of elegance in S&M porn. None of these kinds of distinctions work for me. And so I'm much more comfortable sticking with Anne Rice, and we both are pretty adamant about saying that we're pornographers.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
John Preston's recent anthologies include A Member of the Family, Gay Men Write About Their Families, Hometowns, Gay Men Write About Where They Belong, and Flesh and the Word, all published by Dutton. There's also a new edition of his cult classic, Mr. Benson. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on Bill Clinton's visit to Washington?
Well, we'll be hearing from Elizabeth Arnold about the president-elect's visit with President Bush, and from Phyllis Crockett about the block, the street in Washington that Bill Clinton paid a visit to today. She was there before he was. We'll also be hearing about the arrival of a boatload of more than 3,000 Somali refugees in Yemen, the fighting in the streets of Islamabad, Pakistan, and other Pakistani cities today involving supporters of Benazir Bhutto and those of troops of the government. And also we'll be hearing an interesting pairing, Craig Claiborne on table manners and Penn Jillette on how to play with your food.
Okay, thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Spike Lee's new movie, Malcolm X, was controversial even before it started production. The film, all 3 hours and 21 minutes, finally opened today in theaters across the country. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
I've always felt that Spike Lee was better at demagoguery than at movie making, that he had polished his gifts as a self-promoter while letting his skills as a director languish at the film school level. But with Malcolm X, Lee graduates with honors. He's still shameless enough to end his film with an awful sequence in which school teachers and ghetto kids and Nelson Mandela himself all seem to be telling us what an important movie we've just seen. And he still begins in the old reckless, rabble-rousing spirit, juxtaposing one of Malcolm X's most virulent anti-white speeches over footage of the Rodney King beating. But for the most part, this movie is smart and even-tempered, and it's also surprisingly entertaining. This is that rare biographical film that doesn't feel stiff, solemn, or worshipful. Lee takes the amazingly changeable Malcolm without passing judgment, and that leaves room for the audience to piece him together for themselves. What emerges is an intelligent, charismatic, but enormously gullible man, a man who threw himself into any way of living and thinking that captured his imagination, and a man so torn by the loss of first his father and then his mother that the rest of his life became a desperate search to discover who he was and where he belonged. Lee is brilliant in outlining the stages of that search, using a different style for each stage. Garish and comical for the early years in Boston, when Malcolm wore zoot suits and joined a numbers-running gang. Then cold and monochromatic for the years in prison when he converted to Islam. Dark-toned and sweeping for the years in which he rose to fame as a black Muslim, preaching that all white men were devils and that blacks should create a separate nation for themselves. And finally stark and almost newsreel-like for his last years, in which he broke from the black Muslims and softened his anti-white stand. During the film's second half, Lee shows a mastery he's never exhibited before. He gives the movie a genuinely epic grandeur and a powerful feeling of foreboding as well. And with his great star, Denzel Washington, he shows us why Malcolm's speeches electrified anyone who heard them.
Before there was any such thing as a Republican or a Democrat, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Mason or an Elk,
we were black.
Yes, that's right.
Before there was any such thing as a Jew or a Christian, we were black people.
That's right.
In fact, before there was any such place as America, we were black.
Right.
And after America has long passed from the scene, there will still be black people. I'm going to tell you like it really is. Every election year, these politicians are sent up here to pacify them. They're sent here and set up here by the white man. This is what they do. They send drugs in Harlem down here to pacify us. They send alcohol down here to pacify us. They send prostitution down here to pacify us. Why, you can't even get drugs in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get prostitution in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get gambling in Harlem without the white man's permission. Every time you break the seal on that liquor bottle, that's a government seal you're breaking. Oh, I say it, I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
Washington has been a terrific actor for years and years, but this is an enormous performance, broad yet brilliantly detailed, and it wordlessly answers the question that the screenplay can't, the question of how it was that the bright-eyed zoot suiter of the Boston years developed the formidable strength that allowed him to face first white cops, then black Muslims, and finally death itself. The movie's far from perfect. There are preachy sections and rhythmic lulls, and a lot of the lesser characters, especially the women, have a blandly generic feel. Still, those are minor stains on a huge canvas. While Lee was making this picture, a hue and cry went up in the black community over who owned Malcolm X, and what did he represent? Which Malcolm X was this going to be? The criminal victimized by white society? The Muslim firebrand who fought racism with a vicious racism of his own? Or the sage but doomed leader who threw away his divisive rhetoric in favor of a steel-forged creed of unity against injustice? By giving each stage of Malcolm's career its appropriate weight, Lee has brought the whole of the man to life. He's delivered a Malcolm X for everybody.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Bob Alls. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Beyond Hellraiser, we talk with horror writer Clive Barker about expanding his repertoire. His new book, The Thief of Always, is a children's fable. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Rita Dove discusses her first novel. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.